History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In the 1930s, the biggest American media celebrities were four foreign correspondents: Dorothy Thompson, John Gunther, H.R. Knickerbocker, and Vincent Sheehan. They were household names in their day, and just as famous as their novel-writing Lost Generation counterparts, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway. These reporters helped shape what Americans knew about the world between the two world wars by landing exclusive interviews with the most important political figures of their day, including Hitler, Mussolini, and Franco, as well as Trotsky, Gandhi, Nehru, Churchill, and FDR. But they also went beyond state press releases and listened closely to the dissidents in Europe and heard alarming reports of violence against anyone who opposed these authoritarian regimes. The reporting made waves at home and abroad. H.R. Knickerbocker was the only foreign reporter whose dispatches Mussolini bothered to read. Joseph Goebbels called Knickerbocker an international liar and counterfeiter. John Gunther shot to fame with the book Inside Europe, published in 1936, arguing that, quote, unresolved personal conflicts in the lives of various European politicians may contribute to the collapse of our civilization. In the face of increasing violence in Europe, these reporters had to decide whether they would remain on the sidelines or advocate for their readers to respond. They warned their readers that the dictators wouldn't be satisfied with their territories they conquered, and they objected to the policies of appeasement and predicted the coming of the Second World War. Putting together the stories they covered, the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 1935, the Spanish Civil War that broke out the next year, the German annexation of Austria, and the carve-up of Czechoslovakia, and made very accurate judgments about what would come next. The story of these four journalists is told by today's guest, Deborah Cohen, author of the new book, Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. So we'll see how these figures told the major stories of the day, how they gathered news, how the journalistic sausage was made in the 1930s, but also how they shaped opinion as opinion columnists and book authors. So questions about objectivity in the media aren't new to the 21st century, but age old. And the questions about whether reporters should be eyewitnesses or advocates are just as relevant then as they are now. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Deborah Cohen. Today, there's an incredible distrust of corporate media in the United States. Before our interview, I went online and looked up a Gallup poll of trust in news media, and it started in 1998 and went up to 2020. And it went from a high of 54%. And today, it's as low as 32%, and it hovers around one-third of the public trusting it. But I think most people understand that there was more trust one to two generations ago in the media, where Walter Cronkite speaks with the voice of God about the Vietnam War, or before that, Edward R. Murrow is comforting us during the Red Scare with the words of good night and good luck. I'm curious, in the 1930s, what did the public think of the news media? Did they trust them? Did they still have some latent distrust left over from the William Randolph Hearst era? What did your average person think of the news media during the time period of your book?
You know, there's a fair amount of distrust in the 1930s. So not only, you know, is the Hearst press still going strong, and Knickerbocker, who is one of the figures in my book, is reporting for Hearst's International News Service, but there's the sense that they're press barons, that they have agendas, and that hard as the, you know, so-called respectable papers like the Chicago Daily News or the Philadelphia Public Ledger or the New York Times have been working since the start of 20th century, but really from the 20s, to try to enshrine the idea of objectivity in the press, there still is a lot of skepticism. Actually, interestingly, you know, when radio is first coming on the scene, there's much less skepticism about radio reportage, in part, I think, because it seems so immediate, as if you're hearing an unfiltered truth, which, of course, we know is also not the case.
Absolutely. And there, we'll see how this is all created and packaged as we get into it. But I'd love to first look at the main characters in your book. And I mean, just by perusing it, you're already transported to a world you imagine: classy hotels where people are dressed to the nines, drinking Boulevardiers and other Campari-based cocktails, smoking profusely, talking about cinema and the latest talkie they saw. The people in your book are mostly forgotten, as you know, but at their time, they were household names. Can you tell me briefly about Dorothy Thompson, John Gunther, H.R. Knickerbocker, and Vincent Sheehan?
Absolutely. So Dorothy Thompson amassed a string of firsts. She was the first American woman to run a major overseas news bureau. She was the first American foreign correspondent to be kicked out of Hitler's Germany in 1934. And she was the first woman political columnist to have a syndicated column, political column of her own. And in the late 30s, she's reaching 8 to 10 million readers with her thrice weekly columns. John Gunther makes his name with a book, Inside Europe, published in 1936, that's a taboo-breaking, behind-the-scenes account of the foibles of European leaders. So Hitler is given to crying jags, he reports, and has, as Gunther puts it, an Oedipus complex as big as a house. Mussolini is very superstitious, and so on and so forth. And this is a huge book of the time. It sells more than a million copies. It's not just a bestseller in the United States. It's also a bestseller across Europe. And it's a book that makes Gunther's name. H.R. Knickerbocker comes from Texas. He's born in Yoakum, Texas. And he's the son of a Southern Methodist minister. He always carries a Bible in his suitcase, though he can swear in all of the major European languages. He's reportedly the highest paid foreign correspondent in the world, as I said, mostly working for William Randolph Hearst's International News Service. And among other accomplishments, he becomes the bête noire of Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels. And then there's Vincent Sheehan. So Sheehan is a reporter. He was working for a number of different outlets, among them the Chicago Tribune. And he writes a book entitled Personal History. Published in 1935, it wins the first National Book Award for Biography, the inaugural award. And this book really captures the zeitgeist of the era in a way that no other book does. What Sheehan is writing about is his own quest as a journalist to figure out the relationship between his life and world events, or as he puts it, the one life that he has and the millions of lives into which it's cast. And I think going back to your question about, you know, the status of the media, what you said at the start, which is that these are hugely romanticized figures at the time. And that's absolutely true. So they are, in a sense, you know, there have been foreign correspondents, there's certainly been war correspondents before, but this is what people refer to as the heroic age of the foreign correspondent, when they become the subject for Hollywood movies. Sheehan's Personal History is the sort of kernel of the idea that becomes Alfred Hitchcock's 1940 foreign correspondent. There are lots of other movies that are made about foreign correspondents in the era, dozens of them, actually. So in a sense, they stand for a kind of truth-telling, although at the time, their reportage is, as I said, very controversial.
Yeah, I would like to follow up on that, because you noted earlier that one of the reporters was talking about the character of their subjects, and this comes out in other reporting with questions on, you know, Stalin's family life, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk's purported fixation on his mother. And interestingly enough, that reporting led to a really goofy biography about Atatürk by Norman Itzkowitz called Atatürk, a Psychobiography, that does Freudian psychoanalysis and claims that the reason Mustafa Kemal Atatürk changed the language from Arabic script to Latin script was because of his hang up with his strict religious upbringing. Just a little kind of funny aside there.
Yeah, Inside Europe is absolutely the origin. It takes a lot of what is the gossip of the reporters' bars and then puts it into print. So the rumors about Atatürk's, you know, gonorrhea as well, he doesn't actually say that per se. That's, you know, that's a step too far to talk about the venereal disease or the rumors of the venereal disease, but he makes an oblique reference to it to talk about his kidney sufferings, his kidney pains, and that being the origins of the reasons why he wants to sort of purge religiosity from public life.
Well, that's an interesting point, because what he's doing is talking about the inner character, psychoanalyzing them. And I think this is an evolution of media that is more long-term than people think. What's imagined is that all reporters had horn-rimmed glasses up into the 50s and 60s and were straight truth tellers, but then Hunter S. Thompson comes along, takes a bunch of acid, and introduces gonzo journalism to the world, and everything changes in one fell swoop. But it's a much more gradual process. So this different type of reporting that these journalists are doing, is it in response to the times, or are they being, I suppose, intelligent designers and introducing changes into the medium? What do you make of that?
This is such a crucial question. So the objectivity question, so it's what you were offering is the idea that, you know, we've fallen from a great height of objectivity that we once had in reporting and trusted media to, you know, widespread distrust of media, which I agree. I think that that is at a high point at the moment. But the what I'm arguing in my book is that these reporters of the 20s and 30s are very much the predecessors to what we think about as the new journalism of the 1960s, Thompson, Didion, and so forth, in that subjectivity, inner life, and intimate details are absolutely at the center of their reporting. And so when we think about this sort of buttoned up 1950s restoration of objectivity, it's just that, it's a restoration. It's something that is resurrected after the Second World War and really isn't characteristic of the reporting of the 20s and 30s. The 30s especially are an extraordinarily emotional time. I mean, if you think about the high emotion of, you know, the Hitler Stadium address, the reporters in some senses are also trying to counteract that with their own fervent embrace of democracy. So someone like Dorothy Thompson, and she's a really good example of this, she feels like what is needed is an equally, you know, heartfelt, public, emotional argument for the importance of democracy and the liberty of the individual. And that's really what they're producing.
One other bit of table setting too, how did these journalists gather news and write their stories? I worked a few years as a journalist before getting in the history route. And there's some stories, like let's say a Watergate, for example, require extensive reporting, months, if not over a year, talking with different sources, gathering evidence, records. Other times, media events can be almost completely orchestrated. If you're going to have, let's say, a diplomatic summit, then a press secretary or a public relations team will come out, give press releases. Journalists can essentially write the story before it happens because everything is prepared and scripted. It's handed to you on a silver platter. Now, of course, getting behind the scenes, you wouldn't just simply follow the lead of a press office. But what did it look like for these journalists to gather news? And then they, you know, run off to the Telegraph office and send it back home over the wire, and then it appears in the press the next day. But what did that gathering process look like?
Yeah, the gathering process, it's a really fascinating to try to sort of go behind the scenes and figure out where are they getting their stories. So they're very contemptuous of handouts as they're known. And partly it's because, you know, who would want to take Goebbels' handout or the handout from Count Ciano, Mussolini's one-time press secretary, later his foreign secretary and his son-in-law. Or for that matter, even from the British Foreign Office or the British India Office on what is happening in India. So their sources tend to be, you know, either the kind of tipsters who show up in the reporters' cafes at the Hotel Imperial or at the Café Louvre or the in Vienna or the Hotel Adlon in Berlin, retailing the latest rumors about what's happening in Romania, or they are from local press that they're drawing upon, or they're from stringers that they're employing, you know, news services, or, you know, best of all, they're from being on the spot. And so, for instance, John Gunther in 1934 is on the spot in Vienna for two really important stories. One of them, the Austrian Civil War that breaks out when the dictator of Austria, Dollfuss, tries to essentially eradicate social democracy as a force from his country and specifically from Vienna. And then the thing that he, ironically, he Dollfuss makes possible, which is his own assassination when he's assassinated later on that year in 1934. And Gunther is literally there. I mean, he's, you know, driving his car through the streets. He is going to watch the Austrian military fire cannons on the socialist housing projects in February of 1934. And then he's there as well around the assassination of Dollfuss, trying to understand in the midst of very chaotic events, what is going on. And your question about how do they actually transmit that news back home? So in the 20s, in the early 20s, when this group of young Americans go to Europe and Asia, the way to get your stories home were twofold. One of them was to cable it in, but that was really expensive. And you would catch hell from your editor if you sent a really expensive cable that wasn't viewed as, you know, imperative, necessary. Or the other way was to send a so-called mailer, which was a longer story that you would just mail home. And but of course, that could take months to actually get there. So what happens by the time that, say, Gunther is reporting that story in Austria in 1934 is that he is calling it in over the telephone wires from his telephone at home. He's got a telephone installed in his flat in Vienna, and he's calling it into the Chicago Daily News' bureau, main European bureau in Paris, and where it's, he's saying his story, he's dictating his story actually into a dictaphone. And the handy thing about that method of transmission is that it evades censorship, because by the time that a censor kind of clicks onto the line, and this is true even in Moscow, you know, they can throw you out as the reporter, but they can't actually stop the story because it's sitting there in a dictaphone in Paris. And so in order to actually keep the news from getting through, and, you know, you can censor your own country's newspapers, you can keep them from printing the news, but foreign correspondence produces a real problem for leaders. And that's true of dictators, but it's also true of the British Empire, which is if you're going to keep these people from reporting, what you have to do is actually turn off the telephone lines in the entire country. And that does happen actually in Vienna in 1934 at various moments. But obviously, that's a pretty drastic solution.
The journalists in your book are interviewing the most important political figures of their day: Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, Trotsky, Gandhi, Churchill, FDR. Could you describe some of these encounters? And also, how important were these interviews? For example, would this be as high profile as if Anderson Cooper or Chris Wallace were interviewing Vladimir Putin right now, and the day of this recording is early April, as the Russian-Ukrainian war is still going on? Or would it be more of a puff piece? Could you talk about these encounters with these world leaders?
These are, it's the analogy that you draw is exactly right. These are the big gets of their time. And in part, the reason why these interviews are so significant, and this, your analogy with Putin brings this, is that there's a sense that these are the figures who are determining history. So history is being made by them and also through them. So actually getting to sit down with them allows a reporter a kind of privileged access into the psychology, into the intellectual thought process. You know, it's not the same, you know, you could sit down with Poincaré or Ramsay MacDonald or, you know, any number of kind of normal political leaders. And you got, you know, some of their spin, you got maybe a little bit of a glimpse, but fundamentally, you didn't think that their personality was making history. On the other hand, once you're dealing with, you know, a Trotsky or a Mussolini or a Hitler or a Stalin or a Putin, it's certainly the case that, you know, they are outsized figures who, as Jimmy Sheehan puts it, are managing to channel, you know, the tide of history, quite literally. So how important these are and what you get from them really does depend upon who you're talking to. So the reporters are all really keen to see Hitler, but when you see Hitler, what you realize, and he gives very, very few interviews to the foreign press. He doesn't like talking to foreign reporters, actually, or to reporters. He likes addressing stadiums. And so if you come in as the reporter, what you find is that he's going to treat you like a crowd of 30,000 people. So Dorothy Thompson interviews him in 1931. She's been trying to get an interview with him since 1923 after the Beer Hall Putsch. And she has to submit her questions in advance. She's got a little set of questions that she's allowed to ask. She starts in with the first question, but he doesn't answer anything. He just starts ranting and raving, you know, as if she's, you know, sitting through his usual stadium speech. And then she tries to interrupt him, but good luck with that. You really can't get anywhere. So Hitler is an interview that really is not very yielding. And when people actually try to fathom him based upon the interview, they oftentimes underestimate him, as Dorothy Thompson herself does in 1931 when she finally sees Hitler and then writes a piece saying with the headline, "I saw Hitler." And the result is that she says, well, he's an utter insignificance. You know, such a man could never become the leader of Germany, you know, which to Dorothy Thompson, who is has extensive experience in Germany, has a number of, you know, very intellectual and politically significant friends, it seems impossible to imagine how could Hitler, who is to her mind utterly insignificant, become the leader of a country of culture and serious politics, serious people, serious intellectuals. If you see Mussolini, you might also underestimate him or not take seriously enough his ferocity or his aggression. Knickerbocker sees Mussolini four times from 1931 to 1934, four separate interviews. And Knickerbocker, who has been a adamant foe of the Nazis and very prescient as well about Stalinism, meets Mussolini and he thinks, well, you know, he was expecting a little sort of Prussian dictator type, you know, all formality and starched collar and that sort of thing. And in fact, Mussolini is quite an affable person and they're trading gossip. What Knickerbocker is bringing him is his own impressions from all of the chancelleries of Europe. But Knickerbocker is pretty self-conscious that he's hoping that no one is going to interpret his, you know, rather sympathetic portrayal of Mussolini as an argument for fascism in general. Though he does suspect maybe Mussolini is exactly what's needed, you know, in the early 1930s to knock Italy into shape.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. First, I want to give a shout out to all the great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including This American President, which you can find if you go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Were there any particular world leaders that you would describe as being very adept at knowing how to play the press? Maybe it's by charm or guile, or this isn't the time period in your book, but jumping to the 1970s, Idi Amin of Uganda lent into his outside buffoonish caricature of himself, which sort of charmed the press and deflected them from the terrible things that were happening right under and then eventually bubbling over onto the surface. Which world leaders do you think managed press the best?
I think Mussolini famously, you know, was a very appealing interview. He liked, as I said, the gossip. He was very well informed himself. Knickerbocker was one of the journalists that Mussolini read very carefully and admired. All of them are trying to charm, you know, other than Hitler. When you interview someone like Goebbels, for instance, or Trotsky, they are trying to charm you, and the reporters understand that. And there's a kind of funny dynamic as well, which is so many of these authoritarian leaders and their hangers-on, the henchmen, are themselves, of course, pressmen, journalists. Goebbels, Trotsky, Mussolini's foreign secretary, Count Ciano, and on and on. And there's a way in which these encounters are both, you know, quite cagey and then psychologically revealing on both sides. Because you could say that, you know, these men are, in a sense, kind of alter egos. The reporter is a kind of alter ego for the dictator, which is that they too, the reporters also want to make history. They don't just want to be witnesses. They want to be participants in this period. And, you know, I had said before that Goebbels becomes completely obsessed with Knickerbocker. So he's writing about Knickerbocker quite frequently in his private diaries, Goebbels. And in 1942, when, you know, the Germans have other problems other than H.R. Knickerbocker, they're essentially the Red Army is collaring the German army, the Wehrmacht, in the Soviet Union. Goebbels is writing in his diary. He's reading Knickerbocker's new book, and he's writing in his diary about it. And he says something so revealing, which is, he says, you know, Knickerbocker, this is a piece of trash, complete propaganda. The only place for it is the waste paper basket. And then he says, what Knickerbocker doesn't understand is that journalists do not make history. only military men and leaders and politicians make history. And so I think that that sense of the real struggle between the journalists and these authoritarian leaders comes through very well. And I should add, actually, it's not just the authoritarians, because anti-colonial nationalists like Gandhi and Nehru were also very savvy in their courtship of especially the American press, whom they view with good cause as being much more sympathetic to their struggles against the British Empire than other reporters, certainly than the British or than the French reporters. And so they're very carefully cultivating them, that the anti-colonial leaders are very carefully cultivating American reporters.
All of the journalists in your book travel extensively. There are maps in the beginning of your book that show their travels, and they're going to essentially every European capital, to Moscow, to Persia, to China, spending who knows how many hundreds or thousands of hours on trains, rickety propeller-driven aircraft, standing in contrast to the caricature of a wealthy paid foreign correspondent today, like a New York Times Thomas Friedman. And the slam against him is that he shows up to Davos or these international summits and will speak to world leaders. And the only on-the-ground news he gets is when he's going from his cab from the airport to the Four Seasons. He'll talk with a cab driver, and that's as far as his reporting goes. And I say that as someone who, when I was a young journalist, really admired Thomas Friedman and read his books about the Lebanese Civil War. But can you tell me, what were the most important stories that were broken by these journalists, whether it was speaking with world leaders or gathering intelligence from stringers or whatever?
So they are, you know, at the heart of really pretty much every major news story that is happening in the 20s and 30s. And so whether that's Vincent Sheehan in 1929 in Palestine, who is there for the riots that begin at the Western Wall and then spread, you know, throughout Palestine. And Sheehan himself, who has come to Palestine to report as, you know, for a Zionist paper, feels that he has to surrender that job, that commission, because fundamentally what he sees there is that the trouble being stored up for the future is immense. So he sees a conflict that, as he puts it, will last for generations, if not forever, in 1929, in a period when other people think, or at least are trying to persuade themselves, that this, you know, can be solved and is, or even easily solvable. So, you know, everything from works of analysis, I would say, like that of Sheehan, to, as Gunther's reporting from, you know, 1934, from the heart of the Austrian Civil War, to Knickerbocker, who was reporting on Stalin's first five-year plan by traveling, among other places, to Magnitogorsk, the Soviets' answer to Gary, Indiana, the steelmaking capital. So they're really there on the spot. Now, they do shift from being young reporters who are on the backs of donkeys on wooden saddles and, as you say, endless numbers of trains and the kind of hard travel that it's actually hard to imagine now. I mean, I look at those maps at the front of my book and I just feel exhausted just looking at them. You know, this just, there's a ceaseless, John Gunther is a young reporter is traveling 6 months of the year. And it's really, really hard travel. I mean, Knickerbocker, when he goes to Soviet Union to report on the first five-year plan, brings suitcases full of sardines because he knows that he's not going to find very much food there based upon what he's already heard. So they really are on the spot. That said, Dorothy Thompson, after she's kicked out of Nazi Germany, turns herself much more into a Friedman-type op-ed columnist. And she and Knickerbocker have a real fight because, in part, I think she writes a review of a book of his in 1935 saying, you know, Mr. Knickerbocker, who, by the way, has been not just her employee in Berlin, in the Berlin Bureau of the Philadelphia Public Ledger, but he was also reportedly her lover. So she lays into him in this review of his book, The Boiling Point, saying, you know, he's run around through all the chancelleries of Europe, but what has he actually learned? He's learned nothing, because though he's a smart man, he is thinking with his feet, meaning he's constantly on the move, and not actually thinking with his head any longer. And though she writes him some contrite letters apologizing later on, you know, that's pretty much the end of their friendship for a couple of decades. So she is becoming someone who's much more of a commentator on events, and of John Gunther himself becomes more of a book journalist as does Sheehan. So they're international authorities, but they're international authorities writing no longer for the newspapers predominantly, but their own books. Knickerbocker remains a real foreign correspondent of the type that we think about, you know, both as a war reporter during the Second World War and, you know, constantly filing for newspapers.
As these figures move from being hard news journalists into commentators, opinion columnists, book writers, one point you note is that they see the dangers coming of the Second World War and are trying to warn readers that they won't be satisfied with the territories that they do conquer, and are warning about events like the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, the Spanish Civil War, the German annexation of Austria in 1938, the carve-up of Czechoslovakia. What did these warnings look like?
So they begin, as of the early 1930s, to feel very alarmed. So as I said, Knickerbocker has been alarmed about the National Socialist movement through the 20s and very worried about Stalinism. But the constant drumbeat of feeling that there's a war on the horizon in their circles is absolutely common currency. So they had, there's a joke in the reporter's circles, you know, when do you think the next war is going to break out? Are you an end of 35er, meaning an end of 1935er? That's that when you think it's going to come? Or maybe you're a beginning of 1937? Or what they're doing, and we can see this, the contemporary parallel today with Ukraine, you know, putting together the history of Putin and Russian expansionism and the tactics of, you know, urbanicide, of war against cities in Chechnya, you know, as today in Ukraine and as in Aleppo in Syria. What they're doing is they're putting together stories that people aren't necessarily seeing as related. Jimmy Sheehan jokes that the only political leader to see the world as a whole in the 1930s is Hitler, and that, you know, US diplomats, that British diplomats see regions. And so they ask themselves, you know, well, what does, Argentina doesn't really have anything to do with Russia, or the British Empire doesn't really have anything to do with the fate of democracy in France. But the reporters, partly because they're really careening from one crisis zone to another, are putting these stories together. And so they are, there's a really insistent drumbeat of pay attention, Americans, pay attention, British people. This is coming. Or as Sheehan puts it, the Ebro, the river in Spain, runs to the Thames, meaning that these conflicts are all connected. We Americans are not going to be able to stay out of this fight for much longer. And, you know, they're the referees, really. That's another way of seeing it, which is that the foreign correspondents of this era are the referees in the world historical contest that's playing out between fascism, democracy, in communism. And so the political leaders are playing to them as referees, and then they themselves are channeling the news to, in the democratic countries, to an increasingly empowered mass public that, you know, for the first time, a majority of people, women included, have the vote. And then in the authoritarian countries, to regimes that really depend upon constant public affirmation. So they hold this very important role as arbitrators.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Many of them are prescient, as you note in your book, especially in the 20s and 30s when they don't have the benefit of hindsight like we do, and they don't understand the dangers of fascism or communism. Some of Roosevelt's cabinet members spoke admirably of fascism, not in the sense that they want to be Mussolini and horrendously subjugate Americans, but it's more of understanding the new powerful tools of federal government and how to utilize them, and looking at case studies of nations in Europe that had utilized these tools. Fascism wasn't the dirty word it is today, whereas today it's become almost meaningless because it means someone who's heavy-handed that I don't like, outside of those who don't know the tenets of fascism. But I'm curious too, along with the successes and those reporters who were prescient, what do you see as failures at this time? And before we hit record, I was discussing a bit about Walter Duranty. He was the Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times. He denied the widespread famine in the USSR, particularly in modern day Ukraine, that killed millions. Some would say that he was a propagandist in favor of communism, and he intentionally and maliciously downplayed it. The positive spin could be that he was perhaps blackmailed and that's why he didn't do so. But what do you make of the failures at this time, whether Durante or others?
They're absolutely failures. And I think in a sense, they're chastening and they're also a reminder of how complicated events are when you're in the heat of them and how difficult it is to figure things out. You know, not that they're easy to figure out, right? We oftentimes impose, we read our history backwards, right? We impose a kind of black and white ability to figure out sort of where the moral position resides that isn't the case at the time. So, I mean, they're analytical failures. So when Dorothy Thompson underestimates Hitler, that's a kind of analytical failure about the nature of modern dictatorship. And that's something that they are the people writing that first draft of history who really have to figure it out. And they don't, you know, there are a lot of smart people at the time, not just Dorothy Thompson, but a lot of smart people who think the dictatorships, Hitler and Mussolini, they're just going to calm down. They're going to become normal leaders. They are going to moderate, that being actually in rule, being in government is going to cause them to behave like normal leaders. Or there are other people who say Hitler and Mussolini are going to destroy each other. The democracies can just sit on the sidelines and watch the show. So we know neither of those things happens. And, you know, part of the historians don't generally think, you know, history teaches us lessons in some straightforward way. But it's clear that, you know, appeasement still is today a bad word, a dirty word, rightfully so. And that we don't any longer think that you just feed one sheep to the wolf and the wolf goes away content, right? We know the wolf is going to take the whole flock. So there's that kind of analytical failure. I think the Durante thing is both ideological. So the rightful charge against Durante is that he minimizes in the way that a number of other people do, and the historian David Engerman is very good on the subject, a number of other foreign observers minimize the scale of human suffering and destruction, especially the famine, as a kind of necessary corollary to the Soviet project. That if you're going to have a crash industrialization, of course, you're going to have some casualties. Now, Durante should have been in a position to actually understand the scale of those, because as you say, he was the Moscow bureau chief. He had very good Russian contacts. He tended to stay in Moscow rather than taking whatever opportunities there may have been to actually go and explore. At some point, those are, you know, diminishing. Someone like Durante is actually able to find people who really do know what's going on. So this is one of the ways in which Knickerbocker actually parts company from Durante, is that when the reports, when the young Welshman Gareth Jones takes that train to Ukraine, gets off of the train, sees what's happening, that there's mass starvation happening, goes back to Berlin, holds a press conference. Walter Durante tries to discredit Gareth Jones, saying essentially he's a young man who doesn't know what he's talking about. Knickerbocker, who's a friend of Walter Durante's, instead writes a set of articles saying the young man, Gareth Jones, who's a well-informed observer, reports about the famine. And Walter Durante writes him and says, I don't know what you're talking about, essentially what famine. But Knickerbocker doesn't believe his friend Durante. He can tell because he knows enough of the Soviet Union. He can tell that Gareth Jones has, you know, supplied eyewitness reports that are much more significant than what someone who is in favor of the Soviet regime and also sitting in Moscow. So I guess what I'm saying is that there are sort of, they're analytical failures that are less ideological, and then they're ideological failures like that of Durante. And Knickerbocker and Durante would tour America after the Second World War, holding kind of pro and anti-Soviet debates, with Durante always being on the pro side, of course, and Knickerbocker anti.
Right. And that's a good way to understand how complicated this picture is. And there were successes along with failures. I'm curious about what you would identify as the results of their reporting, how this affects public policy. This could go in any number of directions. In the United States, for example, some would say that we were caught flat-footed and improperly prepared for World War II, but at the same time, the military machine was already being spun up well before Pearl Harbor. Hundreds of thousands of men were being conscripted. Planes were already being built. So Roosevelt could see this on the horizon. Now, whether that's directly attributable to the reporting of these figures, well, I suppose you could ludicate. So what do you see as the effects of their reporting?
I think, you know, they're very frustrated because they feel that they can't summon enough worry and consternation in the United States. On the other hand, if you look at the picture that historians are increasingly giving us of America's international engagement, it's hard to imagine that these front page reports that are coming from Europe, the huge sales of a book like Inside Europe, aren't themselves significant in molding American opinion in a more internationalist direction. So, you know, and there are very specific examples as well. So Dorothy Thompson is credited with the idea of the Evian Conference, which FDR convenes in July of 1938 to discuss the problem of, you know, refugees and emigration efforts from Germany and Austria. And Evian is kind of a famous failure. They don't end up doing very much. But Thompson's advocacy on behalf of refugees, she really publishes the first modern treatment of refugees, a book entitled Refugees, Anarchy, or Organization, and praised also by Freud, who at that point is himself an exile, an emigre in London. So they have the ear of policymakers. They have the ear of really significant political figures. FDR is very conscious about the press, so he's constantly courting Sheehan and Thompson, who doesn't like the New Deal one bit, and Gunther, who does like the New Deal. But, you know, he's granting them private interviews, and he is inviting them to the White House and trying very much to keep tabs and to mold the ways in which they portray him. It's rumored that Dorothy Thompson, for instance, is writing some of FDR's speeches as well. And then someone like Winston Churchill is extremely canny in the way that he uses the American press. So during the war, before the US enters the Second World War, Dorothy Thompson is getting invitations to spend the weekend with Churchill at a time when British reporters can barely, you know, get a chance for, you know, 5 minutes of questions. So there's someone like Churchill. Churchill really understands that the American reporters are the conduit to major US political figures and also to the American public.
Well, like a good history book, it allows us to step outside of our current moment and reanalyze what we're going through with context from a different era. And something that you touch on is an age-old question about journalism, whether reporters should merely be eyewitnesses or advocates and how far they should go in trying to shape public opinion. And the time period that you're looking at from the 1930s, sort of a reaction to the 1920s, where there's a high-valued approach of objectivity in the newsroom, which itself was a reaction to the William Randolph Hearst objectivity era. And in our current moment in 2022, news media landscape is very fractured with how many cable news channels, dozens, hundreds of different news websites. The most optimistic take on today, some have argued, is that merely returning to the 19th century when there were a multiplicity of newspapers in every single city and they openly wore their biases on their sleeve, so you knew what slant the reporters had when they were giving you news, and the factual, you know, cream would rise to the surface, and then that's how a public could be informed. So I'm taking the most optimistic spin on you know, today.
I know. I was listening, thinking, oh, if only. I mean, I think, you know.
Yeah. So that's the nicest take. And then, of course, the most pessimistic spin, you could talk about that all day, that, you know, there's information warfare, something straight out of Pravda or the Soviet Union, but everybody is doing it now. And now we have big data analytics and social credit score and everything. It's just going crazy. But I suppose in this episode, what do you think this tells us about our current moment with your book on the question of merely providing informational raw material to the public that reporters should do versus advocating and trying to warn them against dictatorships, that they're not just going to sit on the sideline and wait this out, but try to stop it. So what do you think this story tells us about today?
I think that one of the things that authoritarianism brings with it is almost inherently for reporters the dilemma about what to report. Because if you have you know, lies from one side. So if Goebbels tells you something, are you supposed to report it straight face? Or do you report what you see? And almost instantly, you're in the land of subjectivity. And I think what my book shows is a couple of things. So first of all, John Gunther is in Berlin in right after the Nazi takeover, not right after the Nazis come to power in January of 1933, and he stays for a couple of months. And his editor at the Chicago Daily News, you know, this is a liberal paper, says, you know, please stop sending us all of this stuff about Nazis beating people up on the street. we need much more balanced reporting. To which Gunther says, what are you talking about? am I not supposed to report that Nazis are beating people up on the street? That's what's happening. And I think the second thing that I became really clear to me is that part of the argument for objectivity in news reporting was also a business argument, which is if we report, if people feel that this is, you know, all the news that's fit to print, that this is the news that you can trust, that they will buy our papers or they'll listen to our channels. But of course, subjectivity sells maybe even better, which is having a standpoint, even lying. And what someone like Dorothy Thompson realizes as a columnist is that a kind of the thing that a high emotional pitch is what people want to read. So she's very much channeling what she views as the opinions of millions of people. And she pretty much says, you know, on the eve of the Second World War, before war is declared, she says, you know, do you feel as I do, this feeling that everyone is sick in their hearts and in their brains and in their minds? And that was also really effective. People wanted to feel, you know, that kind of emotionality, that the collapse of the boundaries between themselves, their inner lives and geopolitics were actually being understood.
Well, as we've alluded to the war in Ukraine at the moment, this topic is very contemporary. And I think stepping outside of 2022 and looking into the past can help us give really good perspective on what's happening today. And plus, it's just a great story. So a lot going on for it. So for listeners who want to read your book, the name of it is Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really fun to get to talk to you.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode and all my other ones as well, go to parthenonpodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening and see you next time.